Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Spotlight Friday episode, and today I'm going to be talking about five different books that I read recently. We're going to be talking about Female Furies number one. We're also going to talk about Die number three, Prodigy number three, Self-Made number three, and the first issue of Chip Zdarsky's Daredevil run. So let me start off with Female Furies. It's written by Cecil Castellucci. Illustrator is Adriana Mello. Colors are by Hi-Fi and letters are by Carlos M. Mangal. So this is an interesting series. I feel like it might have gotten greenlit because of the success of Mr. Miracle. Obviously, we have a New Gods movie in development, but it's probably still a few years away. But I remember talking to Cecil and having her be really excited about this book that Dan Didio had greenlit it. And the fact that she got Adriana to illustrate it, I think is a real win. Adriana's art, and we'll talk about it, is just spectacular. So, you know, it's set on Apocalypse, and it has some flashbacks to it. I feel like it all takes place in the past, but there's some flashbacks where it goes back even further. And, you know, to the surprise of no one who has read this book, it's very, the planet of Apocalypse that Darkseid rules is very misogynist, right? It's very prejudice against women. And you kind of look at that and you can understand it in a way because it is such a harsh place. So, you know, anybody who's weak, whether they're male or female, is going to be, you know, preyed upon and seen as something lesser. Then you factor in the fact that the politics of Apocalypse, Darkseid, you know, he's somebody who uses people, and kind of the example he sets of backstabbing and betrayal is echoed by everybody who serves him. People's value is only as much as they can offer you, right? You don't value people for who they are. You value people for how they can help you. Everybody is insular. Everybody is selfish. Everybody's looking out for number one. So you can see why in an environment like that, not only would sexism kind of naturally occur due to the typical female being weaker, but also if a female is weaker or you see her as something less, then you're going to devalue them even further because they can't help you. You're going to take them for granted. You're going to use them because you use everybody. And females are stepped on even more, you know, used as doormats. So that's kind of where I think Cecil is coming from. And so in a way, it's a very topical conversation. But when you're talking about the female furies, you're talking about women who aren't weak whatsoever. And that's kind of what I love right away in this first issue. You're kind of rooting for the female furies, right? And in general, you know, as they exist in DC, they are villains, right? They do work for Darkseid. You know, Granny Goodness plays a huge role in this book, and she is certainly a villain. You know, this is Barda before she escaped and broke away and made a life with Scott Free, and eventually you would consider her a hero. So maybe she lives a little more in that gray area. But for the most part, these are villains. You know, certainly Granny Goodness is a villain, but yet you find yourself pulling for them and rooting for them because they are being treated so unfairly. So again, I think it's a very topical book. I think it's a very well done series, and I'll go through the first issue here. So we see Granny addressing her furies. She's saying the furies are the most elite fighting force on Apocalypse because they have to be, because their women are seen as inferior. They have to do, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 times more than a man and prove themselves over and over, because they are seen as lesser. So Granny is kind of giving a pep talk saying, you are the most elite fighting force. We do things most on our planet would cower from. We get the job done when others cannot. Given a chance, we could have a real effect on this war against New Genesis. There are no warriors alive in this world who are, or the next, who are equal. Again, Granny trying to pump them up, saying no matter what anyone ever tells you, like believe in yourself. And then we get a flashback years ago, and this is the night that Darkseid came to power, and he was allied with Granny Goodness. She kind of had seen the writing on the wall and knew the kind of the way the wind was blowing. Darkseid's father was dead. He was taking out his mother, And Darkseid gave that task to Granny Goodness, saying, "My mother's the last thing that stands between me and the throne. The others lag behind. You go." So even then, Granny was the one who could, you know, most closely keep up with Darkseid in power. The rest of his allies were lagging behind. But yet, you'll see what happens where she doesn't really get the credit. So she says, "I know what I have to do. Leave it to me." And as Granny Goodness goes into Hegra's chambers, Hegra's there waiting, saying, "Oh, goodness, they sent you, Darkseid's most loyal dog, pathetic." The response from Granny Goodness is, "Prepare to die, Queen. I am your doom." And she's narrating, saying, "I was there in the last battle. The most dangerous person is the one who's about to lose everything. Stoke that desperate fire in yourselves. If you do not, you will lose everything in your defeat." So she's remembering this as she's giving the pep talk to the female Furies. And in the battle with Goodness, it's a pitched battle between Goodness and Hegra. But eventually, Granny Goodness gets the upper hand, and she's choking her. She's going to kill her. And then finally, Desaad shows up, says, "Your method is taking too long," and throws her some poison. And then what does Desaad do as soon as Darkseid shows up a few moments later? When he asks if Hegra's dead, Desaad takes credit for it. "Yes, I killed her. Good work, Desaad." So it's just, again, that backstabbing way of Apocalypse. And Granny, again, as she's remembering this and kind of relaying the events to her Fury, she's saying, "Furies, Darkseid, your master too, obey his will. Do not be distracted by words in a fight. Close your ears." And again, she's giving him advice from things she learned. You know, she got distracted by Desaad, and he ended up getting credit for killing Hegra because of what happened, because she should have just kept matters within her own hands instead of being distracted in battle. So she goes on to say, "Use every advantage to get the kill. In battle, we do what we must. We win how we can. There's no you in that moment. The end result is all that matters. There's only our triumph." So we come back up to present time, which again, this is still in the past. Granny Goodness is saying, "I train the female Furies harder than the boys because I demand protection. Show me your best, pair up and fight." So again, Granny has experienced the double standard firsthand, and she wants better for her Furies. And again, I'm not painting Granny out to be some hero here. The reason she wants better for the Furies is because of how it reflects on her, because of the power that the Furies can bring her. So the Furies face off against each other. And I think this is just a way for us to be introduced to them. So we have Big Barda, we have Mad Harriet, we have Arlie, Lashina, Stompa, and Bernadeth. And one other thing I'll mention before we go any further, when we do the flashbacks, like when we flashback to Hegra's chambers and that fight between her and Granny Goodness, Adriana Mello does an incredible job of channeling Jack Kirby. I mean, it's not, you know, nobody's Jack Kirby, don't get me wrong, but it's reminiscent of Kirby's work. The lines are much thicker, things are a little blockier, and it's definitely a different style than she draws the rest of the book. So I really appreciate that. You know, not only are you getting the rounded corners in the panels, which is sort of the traditional way that comics show that something's a flashback, but that Kirby-inspired art of hers is really great. We even get a little bit of Kirby crackle here and there, which again is just, you know, my hat's off to Adriana Mello. She does an incredible work in this issue. So a little later, the war room in Apocalypse, Granny Goodness is showing up, and Darkseid saying, "You're late." She goes, "Well, somebody told me the wrong meeting time. I'm here now with a surefire plan." And Glorious Godfrey says, "Well, that's not really your place." And so even little things like that, right? She's misinformed of the time. The men, you know, as much as they want to say she's inferior and they want to look down upon her, they're constantly doing things like that to her. So they must on some level feel threatened by her, even if they don't want to admit it. Granny sort of ignores the comment by Glorious Godfrey, saying that, you know, that's not really in your purview. And she says, "Being a small elite force, the Forever People have us cornered. The solution is simple. Just embed the Furies in your army and have them perform surgical strikes to eliminate the Forever People." And so Darkseid asks for thoughts. And Godfrey, you know, of course, he's like, "No, stick to the missions you can accomplish, missions suited to your skills more. Goodness, this isn't for you." and Desaad says, yeah, we won't have the Furies poisoning our ranks with their lesser standards. And again, they're just trying to get a rise out of goodness. And she, fortunately, she doesn't know how to let it go. Right. I mean, the Furies have proved themselves time and again. And she even says such. She says, our actions show our value. We've never failed a mission. We don't have to lie to gain favor, Desaad, which is clearly, you know, Granny's never going to let it go that Desaad took credit for the death of Hegra. And Desaad knows exactly what she's talking about, because he says, careful, Granny goodness, don't let your old bitterness poison you. And Darkseid's like, enough, you know, I don't need you hear you guys bickering. So Granny offers to put on a demonstration. Let us show you that we're ready. And Darkseid agrees. And Desaad, ever, you know, poking the bear, always getting special treatment, Granny, and yet you constantly complain. And then we get another flashback where we see all of Darkseid's lieutenants basically lined up, and he says, my loyal right hands, we have all we need for a victory. We're poised to rule Apocalypse, bring our planet to glory. Goodness, stay here and clean up. We'll talk of your future when I return. And she says, as you command, Darkseid, toward my glorious future. And even I'm like, this isn't a reward. She's the one woman, you know, amongst the males here. And he's telling her to clean. I don't see how that's special treatment, but Desaad, you know, ever the scumbag, unbelievable special treatment again. And later that night, we find that it's not special treatment in as much as Darkseid wants to reward her as he wants to use her. He says, battle makes me hungry for what food cannot fill. Come here, goodness. And she tries to refuse. He says, you'll have power in my new reign, but you must give yourself to me completely. And when she tries to say no, he says, do as I say and rise higher than anyone, or refuse and find yourself back among the lowest of the low. So, you know, this isn't unfortunately a rare thing, right? When in a male dominated society, he's going to, you know, take advantage of her physically and satiate his you know, physical needs. And she either does it or she loses everything, basically. So not a good situation. But she's ambitious and she knows that she's got to go along. So she says, I will obey. She wakes up the next morning. And again, this flashback, you know, all done in that kind of Kirby-esque style with Kirby crackle and such. She wakes up, Darkseid's gone. She's like, crap. She knows she's in trouble. And so she heads to the war room, and Darkseid's talking about how he's in pursuit of the anti-life equation, and they're going to go after the new gods. And when she walks in, Darkseid says, you're late again. She's like, well, I wasn't informed we were meeting early, though I thought I had your ear last night. And Desaad's muttering under his breath, man, she won't be punished for being late again. But it's already too late for Granny. He says, it's all been decided. You'll be in charge of the orphanage. So not exactly what he had promised her, right? That she would be, you know, risen above all else. And as the men laugh, she says, I'm not going to be a glorified nanny. You know, I'm equal to any of these guys. I'm a more valuable asset than them, and I won't stand for it. He said, listen, I'm entrusting you with the children who are our future. So be glad for the role or you're done. So again, using his place of power, manipulating, lying, you would expect nothing less from Darkseid. And you think maybe Granny would be smart enough to, to kind of see that and know that. I mean, she knows Darkseid. He killed his own mother, for God's sake, but she's ambitious and she's kind of stuck, because in this society, that's kind of just the way things are. It's the constant poking and the constant belittling, because even as she's saying this, showing her emotion and saying it isn't right, and Glorious Godfrey's like, you know, you need to remain calm in front of a leader. Hysterical is not a good look for you. So again, poking, you know, it's that old stereotype. Oh, women can't control their emotions. Women are crazy. And Desaad blames her, accuses her of using sex to gain favors. She didn't want to have sex with Darkseid, you know? It's like she's in such an untenable position here. And she even says, that, you know, this is lies. I work and fight twice as hard as any of you, and I'm better than all of you. And they say, well, that might be so, but you're also the only one of us suited to do women's work. So that's why you're at the orphanage. That's why you have to clean up. And you can see the resentment on Granny's face, saying, you're all weak. You're too weak to handle being a woman on Apocalypse for even 1 minute. So Granny takes over the orphanage. You know, she doesn't really have a choice. So meanwhile, back in the present, the female Furies are putting on a show, a sparring session for the Darkseid and the rest, Glorious Godfrey, Desaad, and the rest. And they're very impressed, actually. say, wait, Arlie is especially noticed because she's probably the most physically attractive of the female Furies. And obviously she's extremely gifted. She's the leader. She's one of the best fighters. And so even though the sparring session goes very well, and Granny says, okay, are we ready to give them the go? They say, well, let's proceed to part two. And Granny's like, what else could they show you? They've proven their worth 1,000 times over. And then we're in kind of the locker room, and all the female Furies have their heads down, and they're complaining, saying, I won't do it. This is ridiculous. And Granny says, a minor setback, a law left in the books from an uninvolved time. And they're saying male troops don't have to suffer these inspections. This is ridiculous. But basically they're like, make them put on a beauty pageant, basically. And even Willick, who, you know, one of the right hands of Darkseid, he shows up and says, you know, ready for inspection. And again, he's in a female locker room. They're barely clothed, and he's making unwanted advances. Arlie, you smell wonderful. She says, remove your hand or lose it. And then next, it's a bake-off of all things, with the men saying, well, this food tastes terrible. I mean, what does that have to do with fighting, right? Making them bake. And then evening gowns, really? Making them wear dresses? These warriors? I mean, they even say, what the hell is this? Am I dead or delirious? And Bart is complaining, this is a useful piece of clothing. I can't even fight in this. Then there's a smile contest, and they're all in two-piece bathing suits. You know, they're not happy at all, and you can't blame them. You know, they're being objectified, basically. And the men are complaining, saying, where's your smile? More teeth. So it's completely ridiculous. It has nothing to do with our capabilities as fighters. It's just a way for the men to say, well, you failed. Because when Granny Goodness goes to Darkseid and said, okay, the time has come. Furies need to have equal standing. You know, we've done everything you asked. You've had your laugh. But Darkseid says, no, you fail. And the men say, well, the scores are just too low. You're not ready to join us. You know, better luck next year. It's all at her expense. They never had any intention of allowing the Furies to fight. And here's the thing about it. Like, the Furies would help them win battles, right? But they would rather keep the females subjugated than use them. They just see them as so much less. So Granny is furious, and she says, Furies back to training. We're going to redouble our efforts. You know, there's no room for anybody being weak. And we see Willick is there observing their training lesson. And he seems very fixated on Arlie. And he says, you know what, send her to me for special training. And the other Furies are kind of taken aback. They're like, well, what's that about? Why does Arlie get special training? She's always being selected for something special. And they say, well, it's because she looks the way she looks. She's asking for attention. And Arlie's like, no, that's not it at all. He's a creep. I won't go. I don't want to do this. And Granny, despite knowing this, she has to know, because she's been through it herself in her past. She's so ambitious, and she wants what she wants. And so she tells Arlie, you're not going to mess this up for us. Fury's going to do whatever it takes. So you'll do it because I said you'll do it, and you have to obey me. And Arlie, you know, ever the soldier, says, okay, Granny, I'll do it. I won't disappoint you. It won't happen again. So Arlie goes to Willick, and they have their training session. They spar next to each other, and he's got his hands all over her the whole time, and she's keeps fighting him off. And by the end of it, she's furious. And Willick says, well, that was lovely, and you were lovely. And she's like, that was the most basic instruction. That's just ridiculous. I didn't learn anything. All you did was paw me. And I declined further instruction. But Willick, he's not about to have. He's like, you'll come again or I'll have you demoted. So she's kind of stuck in that spot. She's not happy about it. Meanwhile, Arlie and Barda are supposed to go on a mission that somebody has escaped from the orphanage, and they're supposed to go and find her. And Barda's waiting and waiting and waiting. They say, Barda, what's going on? Why is it, you know, what's the delay? Well, Arlie is still not here. She's not done with Willick. And then finally she shows up, and Barda kind of, you know, jumps on her saying, finally, I've been waiting an hour. Granny needs us to go find this runaway youth. And Arlie is like, you know what? I wish you had interrupted. It would have been a relief. And Barda, not really being privy to what happened, although she should understand being a woman on Apocalypse, she says, stop complaining. Any of us would trade places with you in a heartbeat to get private instruction from Willick. And he says, you know what? As leader of the Furies, I would never let any of you suffer and take my place. That's Arlie's response. And so they quickly track down the orphan that ran away. And she's saying, I won't go back. Hyman preaches a different way. Hyman being one of the new gods. Barda says, well, Hyman's a spy from New Genesis. He's poisoning your mind. Just, you know, come back with us. And Arlie says, but look at how calm she is. Actually, she's found, she has peace. Is there a better life? Is the way of New Genesis better? So you can see the seed planted right there. But before they can even think about it, the girl breaks free of Barda and is about to run away when somebody boom tubes in, and it's Rublon, who is Steppenwolf's son. And he's no different than the rest of the men on Apocalypse. He says, typical, they send two men to do one man's job. I'll take over now. Willick's orders. So again, Willick, you know, he seems to be the worst of the worst, you know, just probably doing it just to get back at Orly, you know, for trying to avoid or rebuff his advances, you know, kind of like a kid on the playground pulling a girl's pigtails or something. And when Orly says, you know, well, we have this under control. Like, look, I didn't ask you. We know how to take care of wayward girls, and the protectorate is in charge. And Arlie says, this is my command. Do as I say. She says, nope, the protector trumps granny goodness. So, you know, I'll take the girl with me. You can submit whatever report you want, because Arlie says, we had this handled. I'll be reporting you. Well, report away. You're just a Fury. Nobody's going to care. And as he's about to leave with the girl, as Rublon's about to boom tube away with her, he whispers to this runaway, saying, give me a kiss, girl, and your torture will be less severe. And that's it. Like, that just snaps something in Harley. She just got rejected along with the rest of the Furies, even though she knows she's more qualified and a better fighter than 99% of Darkseid's army. And then she put up with Willick and all that crap all day. She just snaps and she says no. And she grabs him as the girl boom tubes away on her own, with Barda trying to grab her, saying, Orly, what's wrong with you? Stay on task. She's getting away. But Orly, you know, it was all in one motion. Basically, she grabs Rublon and then just slashes his throat, like nearly decapitates him, because she's just had it. She's sick of being treated as something less, and having Rublon try to take advantage and abuse that girl in front of him. Something just, like I said, snaps. And Barda's like, what the hell are you doing? You said it yourself. That's Steppenwolf's bastard son. And Arlie says, doesn't matter who he was. He was going to harm that girl. She's like, so what? She's a runaway. She deserved to be punished. Like, what have you done? And Arlie says, don't forget, I'm the leader. And I'll punish you if you don't help me dispose of Rublon. If we don't, we'll both be dead. So Barda's like, well, I don't really have much choice. I'll follow your command, because you're the strongest and the best of us. And she picks up Rublon's body, and Orly says, there's a passing comet. We'll bury him up there in the ice. It'll burn up in the sun. Nobody will ever know. And so they boom tube to the comet. They bury him, and Orly makes Barda swear that she will speak of it to no one. And Barda says, you know, your special training was to help us prove that we're better than the males, not worse. And I love Orly's response. She says, this is us being better. And she has a point, right? It's not a way of being better that's going to do any good, because they're still on Apocalypse. But I don't think fighting for equal rights is being worse than the males on Apocalypse. So it's a really interesting start to the series. And like I said, at the top, like the overt sexism, the overt misogyny and prejudice, it's brutal. But in a way, as sad as it is, as bad as it is, you expect no less on Apocalypse for the reasons I gave earlier. It's not an excuse, but these are villains. Apocalypse is a world full of villains. So maybe you expect it, even if you don't like to see it. But it is an interesting series. I'll probably talk about some more of the issues later on. Part of what is so interesting is you do find yourself sort of rooting for the villains here, right? You're definitely on the side of the female Furies. They're definitely the protagonists of this, just because of the way they're treated, and you want them to not get their revenge, but you want to see justice served, I guess is how you would put it. All right, let me move on to Die number 3. It's written by Kieran Gillen, Stephanie Hans on art, Clayton Cowles on letters, Ryan Hughes is the designer. And for those that don't recall, Die is basically a story of a group of kids. There were six of them, and on two of them shared a birthday, or they're very close. Their birthdays are very close together. And the two of them were the closest best friends. One of them created an RPG, a role-playing game, for the other whose birthday it was. And on his 16th birthday, they started playing this game, and they all got a special die, each of them different. One got a D4, another a D6, a D8, a D10, a D12, and a D20, and so on. And they started playing the game, and they basically disappeared. And they showed back up 2 years later, all except one. The guy who invented the game didn't come back. And one of the girls that came back, actually the sister of the main character whose birthday it was, she lost an arm along the way. And they're not able to talk about what happened. We see that many years have gone by. This all happens in the first issue. Many years have gone by, and they're still sort of living under the shadow of being gone for those 2 years. And the fact that they can't really talk about it, the fact that they can't tell people what happened or help to give closure to the mother of their friend who didn't come back, all of that has had a negative effect on their lives. None of them has really been successful. I mean, they have jobs and they have family. Some of them do. A couple of them are divorced, but they're certainly not happy. And like I said, the disappearance, the fact that they were gone, that hugely significant event in their life, and whatever happened, it kind of hangs over them. And so at the end of the first issue, well, halfway through the first issue, the person that didn't come back, the guy that had the D20, known as the Grandmaster, that D20 shows up on that same character's birthday many, many, many years later. And his first instinct is to destroy it. But then he thinks, wait, what if this D20 is a way to save him? What if he's still alive? And so he thinks that he can't make the decision on his own. He needs to bring in everybody. But even they are not able to talk about it as they get together. But they can't talk about what happened, but they can talk about the D20 showing up. And he explains that his first instinct was to destroy it, but he didn't feel like he had the right to make that decision on his own. And what should they do? And before they can even decide, the D20 sucks them back into that world. And they are not happy to be there. And we learn how they got home. Basically, they all had to want to come home. And so after they had defeated, or thought they defeated, the old Grandmaster, they all wished to go home, basically, you know, kind of clicked their ruby slippers together. But like I said, Solomon got left behind. And so in order to return home again, they should have to only do the same thing, right? Just all wish to go home. But what we find is that Saul killed the old Grandmaster. He's Grandmaster now, and he seems to have sort of lost his mind. And he's like, hey, you guys are back, and we just want to play the game. I'm the ruler here now. We can do whatever we want. And the other five, they just want to go home. And so what's it going to take? They're going to have to travel to the Citadel or the castle or whatever you want to call it, where Solomon is now as the new Grandmaster. And it's kind of unspoken, but you get the feeling that they're like, well, they're going to try to convince him to change his mind. They're going to try to reason with him, pull him back from the insanity he seems to have suffered from being stuck there for so long. And what's not said is, you know, if they can't do that, maybe they're just going to kill him so that everybody that's remaining and wants to go home can go home. I mean, I don't know what other choice they're going to have, really. But the thing that makes it so great, so I know that a lot of people, and I've talked to Kieran Gillen about this, a lot of people love it because they play D&D. These different characters are different classes, and they're not exactly the traditional, like, oh, one's a cavalier, one's a barbarian, one's a thief, one's a an archer, or what have you, wizard. He's made them more complex than that, but really interesting. And they make sense. And in the first couple of issues in the back matter, especially the first issue in the back matter, Kieran Gillen kind of explains his thought process, and a lot of thought has gone into this. And it's a very good book. And then, so they decide in the second issue that they're not going to take the longer, easy way to get to where they need to get to try to change Solomon's mind. They're actually going to go through the dangerous part of the world, basically because they can't confront their past. They can't go back and see people they've seen before and deal with the consequences of events that happened in the past. So it's very poignant and it's very sad, and there's a lot of angst wrapped up in it. So that's basically what happens in the first couple issues. And then in this one, we see that fighting against the mechanical dragon as it starts off. And the narration is talking about Dungeons and Dragons, how before I came here, I used to think a dungeon didn't make any sense. Like, who would voluntarily go to a dungeon? Dungeons have only one purpose, to keep people captive. But I get it now. This world is a dungeon. You know, it's an endless war zone between Eternal Prussia and Little England, which is part of the land, the most dangerous part of this world that they're traveling through, because again, it's the quickest way, and they have lives to get back to. And rather than go the easy way and deal with their past, they're so focused on getting home that they're willing to risk it and go through this land, Eternal Prussia, where it, you know, it is at war with Little England. So yeah, they encounter this magical dragon, and they're sort of pulled into the fight between Prussia and England. And they're not powered up enough. You know, they're not rested up enough, and they're actually losing to this dragon. And one of the girls, Angela, she's feeling really guilty because basically this is her fault. She's what's called her nickname is Neo, and she needs fairy gold. She's an addict. That's the word I'm searching for, is how they described her in the first issue. So she's like this cyberpunk character, but in order to access her cyberpunk powers, she needs gold. She needs fairy gold, but she uses it up as she uses her powers. So she finds fairy gold and, you know, offers it up to whoever she needs to offer it up to for her powers to activate. But by the end of the day, you know, when she wakes up the next morning, that gold is turned to dust. And she's got to find more gold. So the whole reason that they were pulled into this fight as they were trying to sneak through Prussia is that she spotted some fair gold, and she went to grab it, and she got spotted by a Prussian mech patrol. So they tried to wipe them out before they called reinforcements, but it was too late. Reinforcements are here. Now they're fighting a dragon, and they're just trying to do the best they can. Again, they're not really prepared to have this fight. And so they end up having to flee from the dragon. The main character, Ash, ends up in some trenches, because it's very much like almost like a World War II battlefield here. And you kind of get that from England and Prussia, right? Like the Prussian Empire was around the time of World War I. And she's hiding out in these trenches because the dragon has released a bunch of gas, probably similar to mustard gas. And she finds some little England soldiers who are basically on the verge of death. Two of them are already dead. One is his eyes have literally rotted away because he went and rescued the other three, including the one that's still alive. And he has a wound too, but he's in the best shape of all three of them. And he's kind of the one that's alive is comforting the others. And he's saying, just go to sleep. The others are asleep. You'll be fine. You know, I'm sorry that your eyes rotted out of your skull, basically, because of this gas and this fight. He expires pretty quickly. He dies. And the one soldier's left kind of explains to Ash, saying he dragged us to safety. He kept going in back into the gas time and time again. You know, his eyes went, and he was just going by touch. And so that's it. He's gone, and I'm all that's left. And Ash is like, well, wait, why is it just the four of you? You've got these trenches. And he explains, well, that's the way that it works, right? We send in these big blasts to clear the way, and then small groups sneak in, perform these surgical strikes. You know, the way was meant to be clear, and it would have been clear, remember, if it wouldn't have been for Neo being spotted and them calling in reinforcements. So the one soldier left is saying, yeah, there was a dragon and there was a gas and it didn't go well, but what are you doing here? Like, who are you? And she says, well, we're trapped here by the grammar, because I should also mention, so Ash is Dominic in the real world, and he's a male, but in the world of Dai, he's a female. So she is saying, yeah, he challenged us to find a way home. And the soldier from Little England saying, missions from a wizard. It's always missions from a wizard, isn't it? like you always the right thing to do, and you're the only one that can do it. And Ash contemplates telling the truth to him about, you know, the Grandmaster being from their world. But she ultimately decides, you know, it's just easier not to tell the truth. But she realizes she's lying to a man who's dying right in front of her eyes. Anyway, the soldier's saying, you know, I wanted to be a father, like my father, but I wanted to actually be a father, not like my dad, right? You know, I got married and I hoped to stay. I hoped not to have to leave, but, you know, it wasn't to be. So just like my father and his father before him and my great grandfather, we all got pulled into this endless war that seems like it will never end. And he's coughing, and you know, you can tell the gas is starting to get to him. And she says, or he says, you know, there's people waiting for me at home, people waiting for all four of us actually. And can I trust you to get word to them? Can you write a message? And he dictates a letter. And even though Ash knows she's going the other way, she's like, I can't say no. I mean, and what does it matter to give this guy comfort to say that I'll do this? And so he dictates the message, and he's talking about how his great 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 grandfather went, and his great great grandfather went, and his grandfather and his father, and everybody went. And they were always told the war is almost over. Spring will come and the war will be over. And he thought he would be the one to make it back. He'd be the one to be able to go back west. He would be the one that would make it. But he says, I was wrong. I'm sorry. You know, I tried so hard to make it home. Wanted nothing more than to be there. And, you know, I love you so much, and I love our kids, and don't let them come. Like, when the time comes, don't let little Sammy come, because the wizards and the schemes, and they always say, you know, we have to go and the war is almost over. It's just lies. It's just lies. So spring never comes. And as he says that, he dies right there in front of Ash. As he expires, there's a voice off panel that says, in a hole in the ground, there died an Englander. Not a nice hole, but a nasty, dirty, wet hole, a charnel hole. And Ash is taken aback, saying, wait, you're him? He says, yes and no, Ash, yes and no. There's no profit in being so literal here. And again, Ash is just like shocked, like, you, wait, what? And she's like holding her head in her hands, and this man is asking if she's hurt. He says, yeah. Hurt, but not hurt. It's hard to explain. You know, I can see the pieces of how everything fits together. I can see them even better now than I could when I was a kid. This guy was you, who I think you are, or, you know, who you are in our world. He was an officer, but yet he really respected the working class. And I know that a dragon is just made of flesh and bone, like everything else, right? Like, I'm made of flesh and bone, a dragon's made of flesh and bone. He knew a dragon was made of flesh and bone, but it still has so much power. And so I just don't know what to do. And you can tell that Ash is, I mean, if this guy is who she thinks he is, or at least the representation of him in this world, then he has a lot of power, probably. And the man says, well, it doesn't change the fact that there is a dragon, even if he is made of flesh and bone. You know, we all char to ash under the crumble of his breath. But allegories are ugly. Poetry is poetry, and war poetry most of all. And this place is it's kind of an orcish mockery of my tale, my elvish tale, he calls it. And this is not what I wanted. But clearly, he has some effect. Like, part of what this man created is responsible for this world. And I'm sure eventually we'll get there from Kieran Gillen and find out who created this world. Was it Solomon's belief? You know, he's the one that created the game. Is it something to do with this man? And then the man goes on to say, I knew better men were dying and they should be remembered. And I don't know what to do. And Ash's response is, you know, I always felt weird when I was a kid. I mean, I like the adventures and I like the fighting, you know, the stories you made up. But I always like the Hobbit chapters best. And that's like, if you didn't already know who Ash thought this guy was and how he may be responsible for the existence of this world, that right there gives it away, right? Like, clearly Ash thinks this is J.R.R. Tolkien. I always like the Hobbit chapters best. And he responds, well, you're not entirely foul, Ash. Let me take this. And he takes the note that Ash dictated from the dying soldier. He says, once more, I may have a way to get the message to their home. And Ash is like, well, you're going out that way. He says, no, but I'm the warden of this hell. Like, I can't leave. But if there's a problem and I need a solution, and he whistles, he says, this is always my favorite. And we see one of the giant eagles from the, you know, Tolkien novels fly up and snatch the scroll out of Tolkien's hand and fly off. And she stares after the eagle as it flies away. And when Ash turns back, Tolkien's gone. But in his place is the Grief Knight, another of their party. Matt is his name. And basically he's an interesting one, very shy, very much an introvert. And he basically gets his power by being sad, which is, you know, if he's not sad, Ash finds a way to make him sad. So it's a real manipulative type relationship that they have, even though they're the two closest of the five that are left. And Ash feels bad when she has to do it, but Matt becomes the most powerful of them when he's fully powered up. And the more sad he is, the more powerful he is. Ash says, Matt, look, it's, and she's about to introduce him to Tolkien. He's like, are you hallucinating? And she's like, no, I think I met the master of this realm. And Matt's like, I don't care. That's enough. There's a dragon coming. We got to get out of here. Isabel took a hit. She's barely standing. Angela doesn't have any gold left for any of her tricks. We got to get out of here. And Ash is like, well, there's nowhere to go. There's nowhere to run. The dragon's going to catch us. It's going to kill us. But if you were sad enough, you could kill it. And Matt like, no, Ash, you're going to use your voice on me, because Ash is the dictator, right? Like, he's got the ability to almost, it's almost like Jedi mind trick, you know, use the voice to convince somebody to do something, even if they don't necessarily want to do it. It's really interesting what Ash says here. She says, listen, and she starts talking about the situation they're in. She doesn't even have to use the voice. She can just remind Matt of what a terrible situation that they're in. And that's going to be enough to make him sad. You know, and she talks about, you know, I got dragged into this hole trying to help these guys. And this one went back for his friends so many times that his eyes rotted out of his head and they all ended up dying anyway. It didn't make a difference. And this one dictated a letter to me about how all his ancestors, going back as far as you can remember, they all have come to war and they've all died. And the spring that's supposed to end the war never comes, and none of them are ever going to go home again. And do you think we're going home, Matt? And so again, she doesn't even have to use the voice, just reminding Matt of what a terrible situation they're in is enough. And his sword starts to burn. He's probably fully powered up, and it's just in time, because the mechanical dragon has showed up, and Ash says to Matt, kill the dragon. And he takes a couple steps, and his sword is powered up enough that he basically just cuts the head off this mechanical dragon. And as it lies there smoldering, Ash says, do you think I need the voice to make somebody feel miserable here where we are? Yeah, not necessary. So the rest of their band shows up, Chuck, Neo, Isabel. They say, okay, can we move on now? Isabel's saying, can we save the excuses for when one of us doesn't have a chunk of metal jutting out of them? That being her. She's like, we need to find someplace safe. I have to settle my debts with the gods, so they'll patch me up. And I should say, Isabel, she's a god binder. So she doesn't believe in gods, but she has a connection to them, and she can, in exchange for favors, or if they owe her, she can make them do whatever she wants them to do, basically. And she has the ability to call on different gods. So that's what she's talking about. I need to settle up my debts with the gods so that they'll patch me up. Because right now I'm in debt to them for all the power and all the favors I've been asking so far. So they head to the closest town. It's about 2 days away. And as they start on that journey, Ash is going to apologize to Matt. And he says, you know what? Forget it. If I'm not sad here, there's something wrong with me. I mean, we came to die when we were 16, and we thought it was the worst thing imaginable. And I come here now, and I think, where would we have been if we were 16 in 1914? You know, and they probably would have been soldiers in World War I. That's what Matt's getting at. So going back to the narration we saw on the first page, we come to realize that it was Ash that was narrating. And she's saying, who volunteers to come to a dungeon? Better people than us, right? people that, that volunteered for World War One are better people than them because they just want to leave. They just want to get home. As we turn the page and the scene shifts, we see that eagle that Tolkien gave the message to heading west, and then it's shot down. And looks to be an elvish captain of the guard there who's given the message from some of his troops saying, we got another messenger. They won't sneak past us. I wonder what they're sending. And he doesn't even bother to read it. He says, propaganda, no doubt. And he burns it. And then he has another soldier come up to report saying, we're ready. And the commander says, magnificent, you excellent men. Well, you know where you have to go. You can simply walk there. And it looks like they're heading off in the same direction as our band of five RPG players who are stuck in this world. So I absolutely love this series. The first issue was super poignant and so much emotion. And now that we've moved on to the world of Die, it's so fanciful and it pulls from so many classic fantasy stories and elements. And it's all wrapped up with gaming and friendship and real life and emotion. And it really is one of the best comics that's out on the stand today. It gets my highest recommendation. The art by Stephanie Hans is really moody. I mean, normally I don't go in for kind of the watercolor look, but it suits this world so well. The colors are also done exceptionally well. They're very washed out, which gives the story a very, you know, cynical feel. It gives the world a very rundown feel. This world feels like it's a, you know, it's a watch that's winding down, and yeah, it's just done really, really well. I mean, the fact that Hans is doing the, you know, kind of the line work or, you know, she might be digitally painted it. I'm not sure, but it definitely looks like watercolor. But she's drawing it. She's telling the visual sequential story, and she's coloring it. It's all done really, really well. Clayton Callan letter, same thing. The pacing of the dialogue is done really well. The font he's using very much suits. It's not your typical comic font. It's much softer in a way, which suits the fantasy story. Yeah, it's the whole creative team. It's another one of those lightning in a bottle type situations where they've really got a good thing going. And even the designer, Ryan Hughes, you know, it's called Die, and that's a play on dice, which is the plural, obviously. But so many of the designs of role-playing dice are in the book, inside the front cover, or on the cover. And, you know, like I said, each of the main characters here in that first issue, they got, you know, one die of their own, each a different die, a four-sided die, a six-sided die, what have you. And inside the front cover, and get everybody's little blurb on who they are, you see what those die look like when they're flattened out, which is really interesting. And it gives perspective. And then you see those design elements brought into the book in a lot of different places by Ryan Hughes. So again, really high quality, really well done story, really well done package as a complete issue. And each of them has been. So this is a book that I really look forward to every month when I get a chance to read it. So highly recommended. All right, up next is Prodigy. This is also the third issue. It's written by Mark Miller. We have art by Raphael Albuquerque, colors by Marcelo Maiallo, letters are by Peter Doherty. And basically, this is the story of a really, really smart guy. I mean, there's not really any other way to say it. I mean, it's basically what Prodigy means. And so in the first couple issues, we're introduced to this guy, Professor Crane, who is basically the world's smartest man. He's to the point where he doesn't need to sleep. And he can figure out, you know, multiple things. Like we say in the first issue, he's playing like six games of chess and like solving the problem of how to stop a meteor that's going to hit Earth in like 14 years. And then at the end of the first issue, he finds out that there's basically some sort of alien invasion that's imminent, that's coming, where these aliens or these intruders are coming from another dimension. And the conspiracy of it has its roots in the deepest part of American government and other governments around the world, there's like this secret cabal, and he's working with a CIA agent who feels like she can't trust anyone to try to figure out how to stop this invasion. The problem with the story is that this guy is so smart. It's kind of like the same problem that Superman has, right? Like some people have writing Superman. It's like, how do you threaten him? How do you raise the stakes? Because even in this issue, where it starts off with Professor Crane basically on top of a train, and he's freeing, or fleeing, I should say, from these, I guess they're assassins or some kind of soldiers for that secret cabal who are sent to kill him and to grab what he has, because they're him and the CIA agent they're trying to track down information on the cult and you know what they need to know, what are the origins of this this invasion and where these people coming from and such. And so they, in issue two, they go on sort of a MacGuffin hunt, and they're looking for these scrolls and trying to get the information. And apparently they've gotten a good clue. Crane and Rachel is the CIA agent's name, and they're attacked on this train by these soldiers. And so the train gets derailed as it's going over a chasm on a bridge, and a lot of the cars are falling in the water, and Rachel's able to grab the case and save it. And Professor Crane is able to grab Rachel and save her. And then he's able with his other hand to reach out and grab the coupling of one of the cars that's still on the tracks. And two of the soldiers are standing on that car looking down at him. And they're saying, well, Professor, looks like you're out of options. So if your friend lets go, she loses the book. If you let go, you lose everything. And us, it's like shooting fish in a barrel, right? I mean, where are they going to go? So he's got these soldiers, they have him. They have Crane. They can kill him. They can capture him. They can do whatever they want. Like, he is completely helpless. One hand is holding on to the coupling. If he lets go, falls to his death. The other hand is holding on to Rachel. If he lets go of her, she dies, and he loses the case. And she can't climb up because, you know, she's got him by one hand and the case in the other. So they are stuck. Game over. Well, not really, though, because again, this guy's the smartest guy alive. And just by looking at these, and we've seen him do this before, he did it with Rachel, just by looking at these guys, he can tell all kinds of things about them, right? And he starts working on them. You know, that's almost like a Jedi mind trick, you know, just like I was talking about with Ash in Die. This is what you wanted to be when you grew up, hired thug, life's dictated by small financial reward every week. And the guy's like, excuse me? Like, he would just shoot him right there. Like, why is he going to listen? And here we go. Like, your father walked out when you're 5 years old. It's probably your stepfather, probably put you into the hospital. Your mother always sided with him, broke your heart. And Rachel's like, can you stop messing with the guys with the guns? But somehow he's Jedi mind tricking him. And before we know it, they're helping him up, and he's embracing them and saying, Professor, we're so sorry. And Professor says, oh, you have nothing to worry about. You're a product of circumstance. I'll hire you. Come work for me. You can be a better version of yourself. What? I mean, I'm sorry, but it's just so beyond ludicrous. I really feel like Mark Miller's almost jumped the shark here. And this issue, it's funny that I say that, this issue has a picture of a giant shark about to swallow the professor on the front cover. So maybe he's fine with having jumped the shark. But it's just so ludicrous. Like, I know it's comics and you take it all with a grain of salt, but no, that just wouldn't happen. And apparently he's done this before in reading the series. You hear that, oh yeah, he did this, he did that. I mean, he's like more powerful than Superman. This guy can do anything. Like, what's the point of reading this? I almost feel like, because we know he's going to figure it out in the end. I mean, I get it. It's fun to tell a story about like the smartest human, but I think Miller's gone too far. Professor Crane is he's not a character. He's just a plot device. And I don't find it necessarily that interesting. You know, I read the first issue and I didn't even go back and read the second or the third until I wanted to talk about it for this episode. I'm like, well, it had been so long. I had to go back and reread the first issue, read the second one, read this one and I'm like, you know what? I don't even know if I'm going to finish it because it's not interesting. It's too easy for him. Anyway, getting back to the story. Now we see this big yacht in the Indian Ocean, and the professor is going to dive down because he's saying that this is like the next step in that MacGuffin hunt. And Rachel's like, you know, I'm still trying to figure out how you beat those guys, you know, that were going to kill us. I don't get it. And you're going to give them jobs on top of that. And he says, well, you know, I saw something broken in them. People just want inner dignity, purpose to life. Like, wait, what? No, he just would have shot you. But he says, I'll just use those guys to run a post-capitalistic micro-society I'm building on New Zealand, South Island. I have a feeling they're going to do very well. What? Again, it's just so ludicrous. Like, does Miller think this is good? Anyway, Rachel says, okay, well, we're here. We're at the sunken temple. What, you know, what's the next step? And he says, well, I'm going to go down there and you stay up here and I'll contact you if I need you. So he dives in, he's looking around, he's telling her, you know, judging by the architecture, it's like 10th century, should be right around the time the scrolls were written, and they would have had the scrolls in central chamber. You know, I'm entering there now, and it looks like maybe this whole city was flooded on purpose. He's looking for clues, and he says it says something about the Brotherhood will do anything to protect their mission. And it sounds like their followers have had influence for a really long time, going back to the Tower of Babylon, or Tower of Babel, rather. That was a gateway to Earth, to something terrible. This may be what we've been looking for. Before he can say more, Rachel says, we've got company. He's the one here, like, to try to distract him. I think this is everything we've been looking for and how to stop the invasion. And Rachel's like, but I think these guys are actual pirates. And meanwhile, in the water, we see some sharks that are kind of tracking the professor. And this is another thing that doesn't make any sense to me. Like, sharks, they don't go after humans. Like, if a shark bites you, it's usually when you're on the surface of the water, and it's because he thinks you're a big juicy seal, because you're on a surfboard or the way the light is shining on a limb or something. Like, sharks, normally they're not just going, unless you're bleeding, they're not just going to go in and attack you. But for some reason, these sharks do. So I don't know if maybe we'll find out later on that something happened, but they do attack the professor, and he does cut one open, saying, goddamn stupid shark. And now that shark's bleeding, the other sharks would go and attack that shark. But no, they keep attacking. They keep attacking the professor. It just doesn't make any sense. I'm not sure what Miller's doing here. Meanwhile, the pirates are boarding the ship. And Rachel's like, hey, professor, I could really, you know, use your help up here. And he's like, well, I've got some problems of my own. I've only got 12 minutes of oxygen left. And, you know, my only way out is past all these sharks. And I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And Rachel's like, well, you have your oxygen tank, right? And he says, yeah, I'm ahead of you. And he's already taken it off. So his plan is to basically blow up the oxygen tank with a flare, blow his way out, create another doorway where he can get past the sharks. But meanwhile, Rachel really needs some help. But obviously, Crane is still trapped down there. And even when he blows the hole, it's not going to be too long before the sharks are right on top of him again. So he says, well, what I'm going to need you to do is I'm going to need you to toss the gun over the side to me. And she's like, well, I kind of need the gun to protect myself from these pirates. So Professor blows the tank. Meanwhile, on the ship, Rachel is firing at these pirates. And then Crane starts swimming up. The sharks come and start closing in on him. He asks for the gun to be thrown to him. And of course, she like casually throws it over the side, and it floats right down into his hand. How convenient is that? And he's able to kill the sharks and get back on board, where Rachel is sitting there saying, could this mission get any weirder? And Crane's like, don't tell me. I feel bad about having killed all those beautiful sharks. And again, I'm just like, why did they attack him? That's not a thing. But anyway, next scene, the MacGuffin hunt continues. Now they're in Damascus. And they say, we know about the secret society, the Brotherhood of the Dragon. They now know the name. They're an ancient cult going all the way back to Babylonian kings. And they've been bred to have like no empathy at all. And they're working as agents for Parallel Earth. And the only way to stop them is hidden in an ancient ruin. They're trying to trace down where that ruin is. And they think it may be at the Temple of Bel. And so they're talking to this guy in Damascus. And he's supposed to know what the next step is. And the guy's like, well, I got some good news and bad news. You know, the good news is that the officials of the city of Palmyra have been, they're open to bribes. The city itself has been captured by an Islamic state. But if we can sneak you in there, you probably can bribe your way into the Temple of Bel without any trouble. So Rachel's like, well, how much do they want? He says, well, $2 million would probably be enough. And Rachel's like, well, do you think we can have this money wired? Because again, I mean, Crane is ultra rich, right? Like he's a genius. He has all kinds of patents and has invented all kinds of things. And Rachel's like, well, can you get the money? Can you get it wired in? He's like, you know, why waste time? There's plenty locally. An old girlfriend of mine here runs some shady poker games. So I'll just go gamble for a few hours. And by the time we're ready to move, I should have $2 million. So again, just here we go. How convenient. Just like I said, he's a plot device. We need money. Okay, he's just going to go play poker for a couple hours and come up with $2 million. Like it's too easy, right? And Rachel even says, you think that's wise? And he says, well, one thing I've learned in these cases, you got to be open to having fun when you can. And as he's walking out, there's a kid in the cafe where they've been meeting this guide. And he's doing his homework. He's like the son of the owner. And as Crane walks by, he goes, hey, here's the answers to your homework, by the way. Oh, and the manager's stealing cash from the register. He's found a mistress with a very expensive taste. I'm like, wait, really? Like there's just no need for that, right? Like even Crane himself, you learned, we saw in the first issue, you learned by doing, you learned by learning. Why are you giving this kid the answers to his homework? Why are you helping this kid cheat? Like that's not that's not heroic behavior. That's not helping that kid to become a genius like you. You're just like, oh, here's the answers to your homework. You didn't ask for them. What's a kid going to learn by doing that? It just seems so unreal. Out of character. This guy's supposed to be a hero. So anyway, Rachel and the other guy, I don't think they ever even say what his name is. But Rachel wants to know, hey, you know, he's quite a guy, this Professor Crane, how'd you meet? And he said, well, he saved my life. I was special forces and I was suffering from PTSD. I was, you know, on the streets begging and I was an alcoholic and a drug addict about to kill myself. And he just stopped and sat with me for hours and he figured out a plan and he took me to Thailand and he lived with me on the beach working through all the problems. And by the end, I was a different person. You know, he does that to people. He finds people who are lost and he brings them back. So I mean, that's kind of interesting. That's kind of an interesting take on it and sort of what he did to the guys on the train, even though that was so far-fetched and unbelievable. But again, there's no basis in, and again, I know it's comics, so there's not supposed to be a basis in reality, but you hope there's something there that you can latch onto, right? Like we've seen in a bunch of different shows. I think Psych comes to mind where the main character, Sean, he's super observant and he would see things and read people. And, you know, we've seen it in other shows about con men and stuff where they look at people and based on their facial expressions or, you know, their clothes or the tiniest little details, they can kind of read people. But we're taking it like so far beyond reality with this. It's like, you know, oh, he was your stepfather and he did this and he did that. And you know, suppose he did the same thing with this guy. And I don't know. It's too easy. Where's the fun? Where's the challenge? It just seems like he can do anything. What's interesting about that? So anyway, as they're sitting there talking, they get a call from Crane and Crane tells Rachel, I've won the money. I'm ready to go, but I need to be picked up, you know, at such and such a place. Can you count down from 300 and meet me at the south facing window? So again, you know, he's making these predictions. Like, how do you know? Like count to 100. And we do see around the table that these other guys are pulling out guns. You know, the guys that he's just beat at poker as he's packing up his millions of dollars to leave. And so I guess the implication of, you know, count to 300 and be right outside this window, he's going to jump out. They're going to be there at just the right time. And, you know, it's supposed to be all calculated because his brain can see all the possibilities and whatever. But man, life, like, how do you know they're not going to, get stuck behind a slow moving car or have to wait for somebody crossing the street? Like, it's just, it's one thing to kind of suspend reality for, a little bit of disbelief and kind of buy in, but this just goes too far. And I know normally I don't talk about books that I'm this down about, but I read the first three issues. I really didn't like how completely ridiculous it is. And I wanted to share it with you because I do not recommend this book. And that is how it ends with Crane, just like his case of money, and they all have guns pointed right at him. And apparently he's going to jump out some window. And I think I'm done. Like, I don't really have an interest. I already know what's going to happen. Crane's going to figure out some, crazy convoluted way to save the day, because based on, X plus Y to the nth divided by Z times 12 equals I win, or something, equally ludicrous. It's not fun. The dialogue is hokey. The characters aren't fleshed out. We know next to nothing about Rachel, and she's one of the main characters. So I just can't. I'm done. So if you've been thinking about picking up Prodigy, don't. It's not very good. Things just don't make sense. And even like, it's one thing if you want to buy into the whole, okay, he's the smartest man alive and he can figure out all this stuff. Like, maybe it's even magic on some level. He can predict the future. Great, fine, whatever. It still doesn't make sense on other things that are completely have no basis in reality, that are completely fake and made up. Like the sharks. The sharks don't just attack human divers for no reason. It doesn't happen. So I can't do it. The book is just, it's just bad. It's kind of insulting, right? In a way, when I think about it, like, am I so stupid that I'm just going to believe this completely asinine story? Yeah, not gonna happen. It's been a long time since Mark Miller honestly has written something that I've liked. I'm not sure what happened to him. Kind of same thing with Bendis. It's almost like they started believing their own press and believing they could do no wrong. And it feels like lazy writing at this point. So anyway, don't like Prodigy. If you have a different opinion, great. I'm glad you like it if you do, but it's definitely not for me, and I can't recommend it. All right, let's move on to something better, shall we? Let's talk about Self-Made number 3. So this is from writer Matt Groom. We have art by Eduardo Ferragato. Colors are by Marcelo Costa. Letters by Troy Pateri. And the editor's Kyle Higgins. And I mentioned that because Kyle was really instrumental in getting Matt sort of into writing comics. Matt's been on the show before as a Power Rangers podcast, big time in the Power Rangers, had Kyle on as a guest, and they really hit it off, became friends, and Kyle kind of mentored Matt, and they got this comic done at Image. So in the first couple issues, we learn that there basically is an NPC for a video game that has gained sentience. And there's this character designer that works for the company, the video game company, who has sort of been trying to do this all along without really talking to her boss about it or her supervisor. And she's not sure how it happened, but at the end of the first issue, she starts to suspect that she's done it. She's captured lightning in a bottle, so to speak, and managed to create an artificial intelligence, but she doesn't know how she did it. And so in the second issue, she kind of goes out and tries to prove it to herself. She runs, certain tests and finds out that she has done it. She's created artificial intelligence, and she wants to pursue it. She's like, this could be game changing. This could change the world. And it could be worth a lot of money too, to this video game company. Obviously they won't be making video games with this technology, but it can be something amazing. And they give lip service to the fact that they're willing to give her a chance to prove it because they don't buy it. So they tell the designer that they're going to send her in to another one of their games. She basically is going to play alongside this NPC. And if they win, basically they'll give her carte blanche to pursue this. And if they lose, she's agreed to delete this character, but the character doesn't believe what she's saying. Because the supervisor, Bryce Mears, his name,
she's been the NPC has been interacting with him a lot. And, you know, he's been trying to figure out why she's not behaving the way that she's supposed to. And so he's playing the game as well, but he's on the other side. He wants to see her dead so he can erase her. I don't think that he even believes that she's real, and that the game designer has actually created artificial life, and he just wants her gone so he can finish completing his game, right? So that's kind of the setup. And this whole issue is basically them fighting, them playing this sort of this first person shooter to try to figure out or try to basically fight to see who wins and who's going to
get their way, basically. Like, is this AI going to be deleted, or is Rebecca, who's the game designer, is she going to be able to sort of pursue this avenue and try to discover what she was finally able to do in creating life, in creating this NPC, Amala, who apparently has sentience. So that's kind of the setup, and it starts off, Amala and Rebecca are dropped into the game, and Amala, she's created as an NPC for a fantasy game. So when they're dropped into this first person shooter, and it's kind of this post-apocalyptic sort of technological world, and they have guns and they have battle armor, and Rebecca's trying to explain to her, look, I can tell you where we are and what's going on, but it's kind of complicated. And Amala's like, wait, complicated? I defeated Taranak and I stopped Brycemere and I saved everyone. I saved my people. Because again, that's what she was doing in the fantasy game. She kept taking over for Brycemere, who was basically, you know, playing the game and was supposed to, you know, win the day by defeating Taranak, who was like the head bad guy or whatever, final boss, if you want to put it in gaming terms. But Amala kept taking over, and she was the one that would win the day. And now that, you know, they've taken her out of that game and put her in this one, and she's like, what? I don't understand what's going on. She recognizes Rebecca from the test that Rebecca was doing with her to prove that she had independent intelligence. It's like, I recognize you, but like, what's going on? What is this world? What's this armor I'm wearing? What's this gun? What's this technology? Is it Taranak? You know, he's a wizard. Did he put something in my mind? And Rebecca's like, I don't have time to explain it to you. Life's not a fairy tale. I was hoping you would understand, but I guess we can just, you know, chalk that up to another one of my failures. My failure to understand how I created you, but we need to go. But before they can, all of a sudden there's a big scream, and Rebecca said, that's why we need to go and get into hiding, because Bryce is on his way. But before they can make another move, Bryce shows up, and he's got like these two like glowing laser swords and a whole army of these, what looks to be like half robot, half zombie creatures with like razor claws. And Rebecca starts firing a gun, telling Amala to run. And Bryce is like, yeah, drag this out. Cause I really don't want my catharsis to be too brief. And Amala recognizes him as well, saying, what's Brycemere doing here? And Rebecca's like, I don't have time to explain it to you. Just keep shooting. And so they are able to set off a grenade. They put a little space between themselves and Bryce and his troops, and they set off a grenade on this this passageway that kind of separates them from Bryce and his soldiers and themselves. It gives them a little chance to catch their breath. And so Rebecca's trying to explain. She's like, look, we got to find somewhere out of the way. We got to get outside, because it's not going to take too long for Bryce to sort of fan all his units out, and he basically can see through all their eyes, and he's going to search this whole complex. So we need to get outside, and we can hide in some caves, and you know, we can kind of talk and figure out what we're going to do out there. And Amala's like, nah, I don't understand this. Like, how can I trust you? Like, you're nobody to me more than Bryce is. And Amala says, well, or Rebecca rather says, well, I have a strong stake in your survival.
I'm invested in you living. And Amala says, well, can you promise me that you'll explain it if we get to the caves? And Amala says, yes. And so the gun that they're both holding, it has like a bayonet on the end of it. And Amala says, okay, I believe you. And she pulls the bayonet off, grabs a pipe that's laying around, lashes the bayonet to the end of the pipe, and leaves the gun behind and says, okay, let's go. This is a weapon she's much more comfortable with, right? Just a blade as opposed to some gun that she doesn't understand how to use, the staff with the blade on it. So next we see them sneak outside, but they're ambushed by some of the Bryce's units, and Rebecca is stabbed and she's bleeding. But they do manage to dispatch all of the other units, and they get to the caves, but Rebecca's, I don't even know what you call it, I guess her avatar, or, you know, the character she's playing is dying, like losing hit points. And Amala's saying, is this a game? And Amala's trying to, or Rebecca's trying to explain it to her, saying, well, you're a child, you'd play make-believe, right? Like you'd create dolls and you pretend that they would, you know, do this or do that. Like that's you, you're a doll. And the world that I created that you lived in, Arcadia, that's pretend too. And, you know, obviously Amala's not going to believe this. She believes herself to be real. She believes the world she lives in to be real. It's the only world she's ever known. She said, no, this is Taranak. He must have your mind too. He's playing tricks on us. Like we need to get to Arcadia. If we can get to Arcadia and to my people, they can help us. And Rebecca's like, you can't be this stubborn right now. Like you've got to listen to me. I'm dying, right? This body's weakening, probably only have a couple of hours. And this game we're playing, it's last man standing. So we got to come up with a plan so that when I die, you can still win. You can still be the last man standing, because then we win, you know, and you get to continue to exist. And Amala's like, well, wait, we win, but you'd be dead. And Rebecca's like, well, not exactly. This wouldn't be the end for me. You know, again, and Rebecca knows there's a real world out there, and that's where Rebecca really is. And this is just her, you know, playing a game, basically, albeit a VR type game where that's, you know, very advanced, because this whole series is set in the future. So anyway, she says, Amala, you've got to trust me, because your world's going to become much bigger if we win this, but only if you trust me. So apparently they come up with a plan, even though when Rebecca says, you've got to trust me, Amala says, I don't. That's kind of to throw us off of what happens next, I see, because we see Amala basically walk into the enemy camp saying, I want to make a deal. I know you can hear me through this creature, Brycemere, and I'll tell you where Rebecca is, but in return, I want information. So Bryce lets her into his main chamber, and he's there saying, you know, I should have seen this coming. Of course, you two would turn on each other. It's just the way of women. Did I mention Bryce is a real asshole? Bryce is a real asshole, by the way. Anyways, he's like, anyway, I'm going to kill you now. And it won't take me that long to find Rebecca, but I just wanted to see you die. I just wanted to kill you myself, basically. So he doesn't even care. He never planned on honoring the deal, but he is curious what she wanted to know, what the deal is. And Amala says, well, Rebecca said this is a game, and that I'm not a real person. Is that true? And Bryce gets a real kick out of that. He's like, oh, wow, this might be my favorite of all days. You know, I get to murder my two least favorite women, and I get to break your heart before I do it, Amala. Yeah, Rebecca's absolutely right. You're not real. You're not even close. You're just, you know, a glorified toy that accidentally got brought into existence by Rebecca. She doesn't even know how she did it. Yeah, so you're just an idea, just an artificial construct, and I'm going to erase you, wipe you from existence when this is all over, because you couldn't possibly matter less. And Amala's really, really shocked by that. She's like, oh man, I believe you. But it at least does make this easier. And she pulls out a grenade and sets it off. And her armor protects her, but Bryce and all the rest of the of his units die. And Amala is declared the winner. She's the last man standing. So Rebecca and Amala won the day, and Rebecca takes Amala and puts her in,
kind of looks like the loading program of the Matrix, right? It's just this white room basically with a big screen where Amala and Rebecca can communicate back and forth. And Rebecca's thanking Amala, hey, thanks for trusting me. I know how scary this must be. And Amala wants to know how long she's been in this place, wherever this place is. And Rebecca's trying to explain to her, well, as far as you're concerned, months, right? Because, you know, I asked to transfer you from the game to the core office server, which is a huge virtual environment. But for you, it was instantaneous, like no time had passed. It's just like going to sleep and then you wake up and you're there. But it's been a little while. So Rebecca then takes the, it almost looks like a US, some kind of futuristic USB drive. It's like this round little ball that holds Amala's consciousness. She walks into her boss's office, the one that offered her the deal to, you know, face Bryce Mirror, or Bryce as he's known in the real world, in this game. And if she won, that, you know, he would allow her to continue to work on Amala. And she says, you know, I'm very excited what this means for the future of the company. And this moment is historic. And he's like, yeah, I'm going to stop you right there. Thanks for doing the test. Before I thought it was just some glitch, but now I know for sure that what you were saying isn't nonsense. And you're crazy, lady. You're damn Frankenstein. You've made something that's genuinely alive without thinking for even a second about what that means, implications in the real world. What if people found out that the characters they're playing in games have been killing like actual people, like digital people, AI people, or whatever, but the characters that you're killing in video games are actually alive, even if only in the digital world? Then that's murder, right? Like, people are going to lose their minds. So he tells Bryce to take it. Bryce grabs the ball out of her hand that's storing the essence of Amala. And as Rebecca's protesting, no, you can't take it. Bryce says, company property. Yeah, I can't take it. Who's the winner now? And he slams it down into the ground. And we see the little light that was flashing, showing that the storage device was active, kind of blinks and goes out. And Rebecca scoops up the pieces and she's kind of there on her knees, just a very distraught look on her face. And her boss is like, you're done. Get your things, get out. And don't forget how emphatically we prosecute any breaches of your NDA. And as she leaves, they're in the boss's office, Bryce and the boss, and they're watching her walk out. Say, you think she'll be in any trouble? Bryce says, yeah, you know, it's hard to say. Maybe I could speak to some of our contacts at the department, considering how big our latest sponsorship contribution was to them. I'm sure they'd be happy to keep an eye on her. The boss says, yeah, do it. You're not wrong. Nobody can predict what that crazy lady's going to do next. And she walks out. And it's to be continued. So when the book first started, first issue, I was totally blown away because you get to see Amala in her regular environment. And you just think, okay, this is going to be some fantasy story. And then as the story unfolds, you start getting some clues that things aren't exactly what they first appear. And then right at the end of that first issue, you realize, hey, it's a video game. And then the story opens up even wider in that second issue with Rebecca basically running the test. And we find out right along with Rebecca that Amala is actually real. And here you're rooting for Amala and Rebecca to win, obviously. So Rebecca can continue her research and figure out if this NPC that she's created, you know, how she did it, can it be duplicated? And as you know, character designer, what she has to offer, and is it, the story going to pivot to, you know, a story about creation of life and AI or whatever. And instead at the end here, we're thrown for another twist, right? Their company doesn't want anything to do with it. It's too dangerous. It's a can of worms and they don't. And I get it. Like I understand. I mean, obviously they made mistakes and they shouldn't have done it the way they did it with, you know, basically throwing the character designer, throwing Rebecca out on her butt. That's not the right way to handle it at all. And by no means am I on their side, but at the same time, I can understand their apprehension because it is momentous and scary and possibly dangerous. So I can
I can understand why they wouldn't want anything to do with it. But the story pivots from the first issue to the second to this, you know, twist in the third. And it's just really great, intriguing storytelling. And Matt Groom really, really sucks us in with this, this kind of narrative. And the character building is good too. They're pretty fleshed out. Even Bryce, you can kind of understand. I mean, yes, he's a complete jerk and an asshole, but he still seems real. You know, you understand where he's coming from. He just wants to make a good game. And Rebecca, because she's so distracted by things beyond just the simpleness of hey, just create an NPC. It just needs to, you know, walk and do the things that it's programmed to do, that's in the code. And here she is over here constantly putting in all these advanced things, because all along she's been experimenting, trying to create artificial intelligence, trying to create life, basically. So from his perspective, you know, she's always a pain in the butt, doesn't get her work done on time, always dragging her feet, because it's got to be, you know, so perfect. So again, you can kind of understand his frustration and where he's coming from. Again, not making excuses. The guy's still an asshole. But at least by putting in those pieces of the story, putting that nuance, it makes for a more fleshed out character. And the art by Eduardo Ferragato and the colors by Marcelo Costa, they work hand in hand. They work very well. Good action sequences, wonderful colors, especially Bryce and his like cyborg zombie units or whatever in that first person shooter where they compete against Rebecca and Amala. Like they glow green and it really pops off the page. So yeah, it's a great story. I'm a big fan of Self-Made. I definitely recommend it. Don't know how well it sold, but I am hoping for a follow-up. I think it went 5 issues. I read all 5, really liked it. I'll probably talk about issues 4 and 5 at some point, but it's definitely good. All right, on to the last book I'm going to talk about in this episode. As I said, it's Chip Zdarsky's Daredevil #1. He's the writer. We have Marco Cecchetto as the artist, Sonny Go on colors, and Clayton Cowell handling the letters. So the story opens up. Matt is at a bar. He walks up and he sees a woman there drinking. There's a seat empty next to her, and he asks if it's taken. She says, no, I don't think so anyway. You know, there was a guy. This is his party. It's kind of screwing up everybody's night. The bar's really crowded. So I haven't seen him in a while, though. Maybe he went too hard too fast. So Matt orders some whiskey, and the woman says, you know, every 2 weeks there's a party in here celebrating some guy either got out of prison or like tonight getting out of going to prison. And that has Matt intrigued, you know, lawyer and all. He says, what happened? You know, he says, yeah, it's hard not to know the way everyone's been shouting. So apparently this guy broke into some family's house and the dad came home early and the guy shot him. And it went to trial, but what do you know, the one witness who saw the guy run from the house suddenly couldn't ID him anymore. And Matt says, yeah, that's shocking. Would you mind telling me what time it is? And the woman starts to turn to look at him for the first time, says, the clock's right in front of you. What do you blow? And it's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I didn't. It's like, it's okay. I like to make it hard for some people to notice. And she's like, well, I don't mean to be rude, but you know, this is a pretty crappy bar. What are you doing here anyway? And he says, well, just because I'm blind doesn't mean I'm a hermit. And it's a lot easier when you come to places like this to kind of forget that I can't see, because you hear all the people and the smells and everything, and they kind of fill in the cracks, you know, it kind of makes a picture in my mind. Matt pulls some pills out of his pocket and takes a couple, and she asks what they're for. And he says, I'm, you know, pain. I'm recovering from an accident. And she says, well, can I have one? I love the answer Matt gives. He says, sorry, that would be illegal. So, you know, we know at the end of Charles Soule's run, Matt was, you know, hit by a truck and he was left for dead. And then in the Man Without Fear miniseries from Jed McKay, we saw him go through that painful rehab and everything that was involved there. And I still not sure why. I mean, I don't know if Zdarsky just didn't want to. And then there's actually a little, I don't want to say an essay, but the editor writes about the kind of the process. And so if I ever have Chip on the show, I'm definitely going to ask him about that. But be that as it may, they use that series, that weekly series, 5-issue weekly series, as a gap. And we're starting here. Obviously Matt is back as Daredevil, but still experiencing pain, still not 100% recovered.
So we turn the page, and it's a flashback. We've got battling Jack and Matt heading into a church. And the priest says, "Hey, it's been a while since I've seen you here," and he says, "Yeah, Father, sorry, I've been busy with fights and the job. Speaking of which, I'm going to be late to my job, but I'm kind of at the end of my rope here with this one. You know, I just picked him up from the police station for breaking and entering." And Matt says, I told you I didn't break. I just entered." And Battling Jack's like, "I got to go. But do your confession and get home and clean the kitchen. I'll be home by midnight." And he leaves him there. And as he's leaving, he says, "Man, I swear I'm raising a lawyer." And so the priest and Matt watches his dad leave. And the priest says, "So you didn't do anything wrong? Well, why don't we skip confession and you tell me what really happened then?" And Matt says, "Okay, well, Jeremy Colton happened. He conned Davey White out of his baseball cards, and Davey's not that bright and everybody knows that. So I got his cards back." And the father says, "And I assume these cards were in Jeremy's home?" And Matt affirms that. And the priest says, "So you're writing an injustice." Matt says, "Exactly, right? Like, who cares if I broke a law? God would have wanted me to get those cards back." And the priest is like, "Yeah, well, you know, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's." And Matt doesn't understand. He says, "Listen, when Jesus asked if it was lawful to pay taxes to Caesar, that's how he responded. Caesar's face was on the money, so they were his. Think of it like this. Like, we move through two kingdoms. There's the kingdom of God, which is the most important, but we have obligations here in the material world as well. And there are rules that we have to follow. And, you know, you're a good boy, Matthew. You did a good thing for your friend fighting injustice, but man's laws are still man's laws. So as far as I can see, you did do something wrong. You got caught." So I love that. Like, the priest is, he's not telling Matthew he did wrong by writing that injustice, but he got caught. And technically, you know, you can only get in trouble for breaking the law if you get caught. So it's an interesting way to look at things, to say the least. So after the flashback, now we're in Matthew's apartment, and he's thinking to himself about everything he's been through in the last few weeks. He says, "You know, I almost died. It's been weeks." He's sitting on the edge of his bed. He's naked. We see a voice from the bed saying, "That was nice." And we assume it's the girl from the bar. And as she sits up, we definitely see that's the case. And Matt is, you know, continuing to contemplate. He's thinking about how his physical therapist was shocked at how quickly he bounced back, but she doesn't know that Matt obviously was in pretty good physical shape being Daredevil. But she also doesn't realize that he's not back to the level he needs to be if he's going to operate as Daredevil. So the woman that he met in the bar is saying, "You know, this is a nice place. Are you a lawyer or something?" He's like, "That's exactly what I am, or what I used to be, but I'm trying to figure out what's next." And she's like, "Well, are you going through some sort of crisis? Is that why you're picking up people in bars? Because I'm kind of going through that myself." And Matt says, "Nah, I've been through a lot. The pills I was taking at the bar, they were for an accident I had where I got hit by a truck. It was bad. Surgery, recovery." And the girl's like, "Well, I don't know you or anything, but you maybe should get one of those seeing eye dogs so you don't get hit by trucks. But I got to go. I'm not trying to be rude, but I do have to be at work early. And I don't trust my roommate to feed my cat. But if you give me my number, I'll probably text you or call, probably." And Matt's thinking, "You know, I've been the former leader of an order of ninjas, and I've died before and I've returned. I'm Daredevil. My old teacher, Stick, told me, you know, half measures are for half a life. So I got better. Even after this last accident, I am better. But what, you know, what does that mean? What's next?" So with the offer to give his number to this girl, he says, "Well, you know, trust me, you don't want to get involved with me." And, you know, he's thinking about all the women in his past who have been really hurt, right? And she says, "Well, I'm not proposing, Mr. Dark and Mysterious. You're not my type. But as soon as I realized you were blind, you became much more interested." And he says, "Please don't tell me you have a disability fetish." She's like, no, it's not that. It's that the way I look every day, I'm judged on my looks. And I'm just saying, because I like the fact that you paid attention to me and I could let my guard down for a little bit.
I picked you up with my personality. Didn't have to worry about, you know, weird faces I was making, or I don't know. Don't have to worry if I'm pretty enough. And Matt says, and yet you're beautiful. She goes, yeah, and yet I'm beautiful. So she walks off and leaves the apartment. We wonderful. We'll see her again. So we turn the page and we see we're outside of actually the bar that Daredevil was at last night. And we see some paramedics there, EMTs. They've got a guy in a gurney. They're about to put him in the back of an ambulance. A couple guy cops are talking. They're saying a guy that got attacked didn't get a good look at who attacked him. And the cop's like, well, he probably wouldn't even tell us if he did see. He's like, well, he hurt him though. And that was enough for him to say that he thinks it was Daredevil. And the other cop's like, well, that's that. Let's wrap it up back at the station. And the first cop, the female cop, says, what? And the sergeant says, well, look, my advice, let's pretend we didn't hear that. You know, Mayor Fisk is gung-ho on catching these supposed heroes, and I'm here to tell you, you won't. And her response is, Ed, I'm not going to. He's like, no, listen, we're short-staffed, right? You want more attention on us? You want to drag this out? You want to pile up the workload? Go ahead. Write Daredevil, possible suspect. Nobody catches these guys. You just live with it. And besides, this guy's Pistol Pat Albano, his name's a nickname of a gun. Like, you know, I don't care what mystery guy broke his legs. Things are going to go unanswered. Like, just let it go. And as he's telling her this, they see another police car pull around the corner. He's like, did you call for backup? She goes, no, I it must just be a patrol. And this giant imposing black guy gets out. He's got his badge around his neck, clearly a detective. And he asks the two uniforms, hey, do we know who did this? It's like, well, no, the victim didn't have a visual. So, and the sergeant's like, this is our crime scene, bud. So, you know, I'm not sure what you think is going on. And the guy just ignores him, walks up to the victim right as he's being loaded in the ambulance, says, who did this to you? Without hesitation, this guy, like, Daredevil. So immediately the detective turns around and says, what's your name, officer? And the female says, Tina Deacon. You know, he didn't have a visual. So, like, look, Deacon, I'm going to have to report this, but I'm going to put in my report that I suspect that you were coerced by this guy, Taylor, Detective Taylor, to not mention who the perp's identity was. And Taylor's like, what the hell do you think you're doing? This is my crime scene. He says, listen, I'm Detective Cole North, just transferred from Chicago, and you're Detective Edward Taylor, 18 years in the force, but no major bust, no major anything. But word is you take really nice vacations. And you can just see that gets under Taylor's skin immediately. Like, I don't care who you are, big man, you say one more word and I'm going to knock you flat on your ass. And I don't know what the hell Taylor thinks he's doing, because North is like towers over him. He turns to one of the EMTs, Cole North does, and says, excuse me, son, are you able to radio dispatch? And the EMT says, yeah. He goes, go ahead then, because I think we may need to call in a second ambulance. And he gives a look to Taylor, who immediately starts sweating. And he decides that maybe he should just leave. Meanwhile, Deacon says, you know, I wanted to report. And Cole says, nah, it's fine. It's all right, detective. I understand. But just so you understand, this isn't something we run away from. There's no justice. There's no law here. This man was beaten because this hero thought it would make him turn his life around. Some guy's going to go straight because a man in a devil costume beat him up. No, the man who did this, the Daredevil, he did it for one reason, because he needed to, because he liked it. So Cole, apparently he's got a vendetta. And I got to tell you, like, right off the bat, I do not like this Detective Cole. And it's not because I know Daredevil's motives are pure and what a hero Daredevil is. But what I don't like is the assumptions. Like, here's this Detective Cole, clearly capable, clearly self-confident, but making that fatal, arrogant assumption that he knows better than everybody else. And it just rubs me completely the wrong way. And I think that's what Zdarsky's going for. And I hope that this Cole North is in for a rude awakening. As we turn the page, we flash back to Matt's childhood. We can see that the accident has happened that took his sight and gave him the powers. And we see the priest finishing up his sermon, finishing up his service, saying, go enjoy your Sunday. Don't forget next week's bake sale. And he walks off, or his congregation walks off. And Father Cathal is his name, comes down and says hi to Matt. He's like, it's good to see you here so soon after, you know, the accident. Is your father here? And he said, no, your dad's working. He's always working. You know, hospital bills were pretty tough, but he wanted me to come here, so I came. And the priest says, well, you know, I'm glad you came,
But I do have another meeting with another parishioner shortly. But if you'd like, I can get Sister Wilma to escort you home. And Matt says, no, I can get home on my own just fine. I don't need confession. You know, I'm blind now, and I can't do anything. And if I can't do anything, I can't sin. So I have no need for confession. And Father, without hesitation, says, you know, you and I both know that isn't true. And I can hear it in your voice. You're sinning right now. You're hating God. And the priest goes on to say, you know, you saved a man's life and God took your sight. And that doesn't feel good, right? Everything is not normal. When God takes from us, it can be hard to feel what he's given us. And we see some tears coming out of from under Matt's bandages. And the father finishes up by saying, the beauty of this world, it isn't just one of sights. I know it doesn't seem like that now, but God's going to reveal the world to you in other ways. You're on the road to becoming a man, going to experience the world in a way I can't imagine. And it's okay to be angry at God. It's even understandable, but believe me, God loves you. And it's very appropriate, right? Like the priest, without realizing it, talking about how Matt's going to experience the world in a different way. It's very, very prescient. So then we flip back to the present time. Matt's in his apartment. He's laying in his bed. He's thinking, I can't sleep. I was lying in a hospital bed waiting for my body to put itself back together. And it felt like I was caged. And now I'm out of the cage and I've only been back for Daredevil as a week. But man, I was sloppy. Like I'm still not all the way back. You know, going after that guy without the costume. You know, I know he shot a guy and killed him and then got away with it. But he couldn't get away from me. And you know, having my radar sense and sensing things around me and defining my surroundings used to give me joy. But now lately, it's just felt like another cage, like I'm in a box all the time. Vibrates off the windows and temperature changes. And it all reminds me that I've been gone from being Daredevil for too long. And so Matt decides to go out on patrol again. And he's in Hell's Kitchen. And he says, you know, the air itself feels like it has an itch. And I've lived here all my life. And I can feel it when people are ready to scratch that itch, and they usually scratch it by robbing or fighting or murdering. And Daredevil's been gone for too long, and people have gotten complacent, right? And I've got to scratch the itch to get back. And Foggy certainly wouldn't approve of me doing this and the casualness of the woman I spent the night with tonight. But, you know, Foggy, God bless him, he rents a moving van after he sleeps with somebody. He just doesn't do relationships, but people need to know. People need to know that Daredevil's back. So I you know, run across the rooftops. I want people to see me, to catch a glimpse of Daredevil. Maybe the ones that see me don't have the itch, but they'll tell others. And pretty soon word will get out that I'm back, and they'll think twice. They'll imagine the devil may come after them. As he's thinking this, he slips and almost misses a rooftop. And he thinks, man, I'm not at peak grace yet. But it still feels good to, you know, to be back. And then he senses a robbery. Here's a robbery happening a few blocks away. And it's a perfect example, you know, the devils slip their minds. And we see a couple of guys that are robbing a liquor store. And Daredevil gets there just in time as they're coming out. The boom of their hearts when they see it's me. I'm not going to lie, I've missed this, Daredevil says. So they're like, oh, crap. And even though this is just two garden variety hoods, simple break and enter, Daredevil actually has kind of a tough time with them. There's a third guy that's their getaway driver, basically, who almost gets a shot off at Daredevil with a gun. He's like, I got to wrap this up before the cops come. But these guys, they give Daredevil all he can handle. And again, this is just three regular guys, no superpowers, nothing. And so Daredevil's lucky to get out of it with his life. He manages to subdue all three of them, but just as he knocks out the last one, there's a bit of an explosion because these guys set a fire in the liquor store to kind of cover their tracks. So as they're all lying there, as he's taken out all three, Daredevil hears sirens. They're only a couple blocks away. He wants to help put out the fire, but he can't because the cops have orders to arrest him on site. So he's got to get out of there as quickly as he can. And just as he's about to leave, a cop car pulls up and they spot him, and he's able to get away. But he flees to a rooftop building next door, and he thinks, man, I fought the Hulk, I fought Ultron,
armies of ninjas, and my obituary almost just read Daredevil killed by three robbers. Oh, and by the way, he was Matt Murdock, local lawyer and former mayor. So
he's like, man, I thought I was better, but I need to get better because maybe it's the injuries or the years, but I don't know how much longer I can do this. Like, I almost didn't make it. How much longer can I do this before it kills me?
Next page, we're flashing back again, but nowhere near as far back as we went before. It's not Matt as a kid before he lost his sight. It's not Matt as a kid right after he lost his sight, but it's Matt when he first started as Daredevil. And of course, pulling in from the Daredevil TV show, I think this has, you know, been in the comics before since that show came out, where, you know, his earliest costume isn't the yellow and red one. It's the like the black, just, you know, gloves and normal clothing with a half hood tied over his face. And he's giving confession to that same priest. And the reason we also know so much time has gone by is that the priest has gone gray. I mean, he was bald, but his eyebrows are gray. Now has a gray beard. And Matt's giving his confession. You know, he says, "Bless me, Father, I have sinned. I've used great violence. It was for the good to help, but it was violence nonetheless." And the priest says, "Well, this sounds serious." And Matt's questioning that. Like, is it? Didn't Jesus drive the money changers out of the temple? Isn't violence justified sometimes? Can't I be the hands of God? And the priest is like, the mind controls the hands. And who is God controlling your hands? Because Jesus did drive the money changers out of the temple, but he was the Son of God. And you're just a man. And men, you know, they can succumb to the seduction of violence. And it destroys people's spirits and it destroys people's lives. And I can hear it in your voice, Matthew, you're on a precipice. So this priest recognizes who this is, you know, recognizes that it's Matt Murdock. And we see Matt taking off his hood as he's sitting there in the confessional, tears coming out of his eyes as he's listening to the priest. And the priest goes on to say, you know, there's a difference between a man who saves someone through the unfortunate use of violence and somebody who's going out there seeking violence like an addict. And he's waiting for Matthew's response, and Matthew says nothing. And so the priest, Matthew, and he looks in the other side of the confessional, and Matt Murdock has left, and his hood has been left behind. So meanwhile, back in the present day, Mayor Fisk is getting an update from his aide, Wesley, and he's telling him, yeah, so you have a Board of Trade meeting at 11:30. Shouldn't take too long. They just want some FaceTime with the mayor. Round four, there's a reporter from the Bugle will be here and wants to do a, you know, Mayor Fisk's first year piece. And you have another appointment at 9 with Harvard Wells. As Fisk is listening to all this, he turns on the TV and says, hold on, Wesley, quiet, because he sees on the news, they're reporting the scene of the fire where Daredevil took out those three robbers. And it says, you know, firefighters were quick to the scene. They kept the fire from spreading to nearby buildings. And the surveillance camera captured the three robbers and also a fight with the masked vigilante Daredevil who evaded capture. And police are asking for any information on his whereabouts because two of the unidentified robbers have been released from the hospital. But the third one, he died from head trauma. Fisk has a smile on his face. He's got Daredevil right where he wants him now. Like Matt has made a mistake. Whether through desperation because he wasn't all the way back enough to be in control and take those robbers out quickly. I mean, honestly, you should think it's self-defense, right? But Fisk is not going to see it that way. And Matt, he's not in great shape. Not only has he made this fatal mistake, one of these criminals has died, but on the final page, we see Matt laying in his bed. There's blood everywhere from the fight, and he's, I imagine he's going to be pretty sore in the morning, and it's to be continued. So he definitely is not all the way back, and he's going to have some severe consequences to put up with, or to deal with, I should say. So great start from Zdarsky. Been loving his Daredevil run. It has a lot of heart. It has a lot of feeling. Obviously it's been kind of in the comic headlines lately with what happened in issue 25 and how impactful that is going to be going forward. So a lot to unpack there. And, you know, I've said before when talking about Zdarsky's run, this run is how he's kind of going over things and repeating some things that have happened before, some story ideas that have happened before, but he's doing it in a fresh way with so much emotion and gorgeous art from Marco Tichetto that I think it's definitely worth a read. One of the best comics Marvel's putting out right now. So highly recommend it. And if you can, if you haven't read this, or if you haven't bought it and you plan on picking it up, I definitely recommend picking up the director's cut because it has the script in it. So you can get even more out of the story. It also has all the alternate covers for issue one, of which there are quite a few. And then, yeah, just having that full script with Zdarsky describing things to Chetto is it's a lot of fun. You can get even more out of the story. So I highly recommend it for sure. Anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of the Comic Source Podcast. As always, I want to thank everybody for joining me for this Spotlight Friday episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.